NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Flight Safety Detectives. I'm Miles O'Brien, and I'm joined, as always, by the great Todd Curtis and the even greater John Golia, the legend himself, to talk about aviation and what can go wrong, and more importantly, what can we learn about it? You know, we tend to go deep in the archives occasionally at the NTSB. Sometimes some stories are, well, they kind of develop a life of their own. And this one from 1991 is something that's worth discussing because it does get us. I don't know the altitude at which this occurred, but the term the Mile High Club comes to mind here, gentlemen, as we talk about this one. We are in the Winter Haven area of Florida in a Piper Seneca, December of 1991. Female pilot, and in the right seat is a pilot as well, her friend, shall we say, and mysteriously dropped out of the sky. Apparently there was some structural failures along the way, so there was some real problems coming down, a lot of speed and stress on the aircraft, and both of them sadly died. But based on how we read this report, they might have died with smiles on their faces. So let's go through this real quickly. Todd, what's your, I guess it's never spelled out, like as is often the case in these reports, but I think we understand what happened here, right?
I think we can read between the lines. And this event, as you said, took place in the Winter Haven area, specifically Rainbow Lake, Florida. And the report's a very short one. This is from 1991, December 1991. This is in the era before the public docket really became an important part of investigation. So there's only this report. It's only a couple pages long and no photographs. And in fact, there's only two paragraphs of content here. So I'm going to read the whole thing. Now, the report did mention that the pilot was female, does not mention the gender of the other passenger. But this was a Florida event. But I can't say this was a Florida man event because I don't know the gender of the other person. With that, the analysis says the private pilot and a pilot-rated passenger were going to practice simulated instrument flight. Witnesses observed the airplane's right wing fail and in a dive and crash. Examination of the wreckage and bodies revealed that both occupants were partially clothed and the front right seat was in the full aft reclining position. Neither body showed evidence of seatbelts or shoulder harnesses being worn. Examination of the individual's clothing revealed no evidence of ripping or distress to the zippers and belts. Probable cause and findings. National Transportation Safety Board determines the probable causes of this accident to be the pilot in command's improper in-flight decision to divert her attention to other activities not related to the conduct of the flight. Contributing to the accident was the exceeding of the design limits of the airplane leading to a wing failure. Now, first, let me comment on the technical aspects of this. This was a Cessna, Piper, twin-engine Piper. Piper Seneca, twin-engine Piper. This is 1991. To the best of my knowledge, these did not come standard with either a cockpit voice recorder or a flight data recorder, nor does there
Not in this case, no.
have any, nor is there any mention of that here. So how they surmise that the pilot in command diverted her attention to other activities not related to the conduct of the flight, I believe that's speculation. Now that we're on the subject of speculation, it stands to reason that if there is no evidence of ripping of the clothing, and if there is an intense interest in zippers and belts, perhaps there was a deliberate action on the part of both occupants to remove their clothing. Certainly, reclining the right seat is something that if you're acting as a safety pilot, it's not something you do when you're practicing instrument approaches. So they were practicing some kind of approach, but I'm not sure what. John, in your experience, what do you think's going on here?
Well, it's kind of obvious, but you know what? This isn't the first, and it probably won't be the last time that this happens. I can think of a few others, one in Las Vegas in particular. Yeah, in fact, I think it was in the same general time frame as this one, too, maybe a little earlier. But it really gets to the pilots. Why would they conduct behavior like this? You know, they know it's risky, right? What would drive people to do that? You know, the mile high club has a certain, you know, cachet to a lot of people. But you shouldn't be flying the airplane when you want to join the club. You know, it defies description.
The back seat might be a better place.
Let me add that in the
like it used to be in the car, right? In the drive-in.
Right. The 57 Chevy, right? This is not. Yeah.
And again, I have to emphasize the technical aspects of the report and the fact that we have no public dockets. We have a scant amount of information. It says that the phase of operation was cruise. Now, this is before the days of ADS-B. There is no mention of radar data. How do they know that these two people were cruising? As it were.
That's
just
a great
saying.
Question. That's good. Throwing that out.
They must have had some radar data. Right,
and,
so that
and
piece
of
they
must have something like that. But I will say this: the seat was not just reclined; it was all the way in the back position, rear position. Which you know, if this were in fact truly a you know sort of an instrument proficiency check ride, as I think that was some indication that that might be the case. Clearly, the pilot who would be observing wouldn't be able to do his or her job very well, would they?
I'm going to cut this out, I think. But when you said that they were going all the way with respect to reclining the seat, that's one thing. And you mentioned that there was a possible instrument check in progress. What kind of instrument would you be checking given what's going on there? And again, you're an experienced pilot. And
I don't know. I think it's time to retard the throttle on this one. And
well, let's just talk.
Let's
a little
lean
bit
out
more
the
about,
mixture.
Right. About how stupid this really is.
I know. I mean, really. Listen.
I mean, we can laugh at it in retrospect, but really, two adults,
yeah.
You know, obviously consenting adults. But doing things in the environment that they shouldn't be doing them in.
No, I mean, there is a Florida man Darwin's rule here, you know, that kind of comes into play, right? Not the smartest move.
For a pilot with 470 total hours and 10 in the last 30 days, one in the previous 24 hours. So this was not a pilot who didn't know how to handle the airplane, not a pilot who... Yeah, didn't know the rules of the road, as it were.
Yeah.
And they should have known better.
You know, that 500-hour pilot, aren't they the worst, though? That's a dangerous pilot, 500 hours, I think, you know? You're
yep.
just cocky enough to be not scared. You really don't know what you don't know. It's not a good place.
And unfortunately, they didn't have an opportunity to go beyond that level of experience. But again, this is probably a good time to segue into yet another aircraft event that involved two people and involved fatalities.
But there is a connection between these two dots, and that would be in the category of pilots who should know better doing silly, stupid things. Again, two fatalities. You know, this was what's interesting to me on this one is you had a you have a Cessna 150, and this was an aircraft that was involved was flying into some very low weather. I think it was about a 600 foot ceiling. Visibility is okay, but the low ceiling at night. Two people on board, and as it turns out, based on information data, the sort of unofficial cockpit voice recorder these days is the GoPro for so many of these accidents. In this case, a GoPro was operating. So there was a lot of evidence as to what was going on board this aircraft. But there was a lot of selfies being taken, but it was a classic case, taking aside the distraction factor of, VFR flight into IMC conditions. And this was an instrument rated pilot, but apparently didn't have all his proficiencies where they should be, and he was not current. I got to ask you this before we go any further on this one. This is a 150, two people in it, obviously, no more than that. Have you ever seen a Cessna 150 that is equipped for instrument flight? I have never seen one, but I don't know if that exists. That maybe it exists.
My experience, and it's been years ago, with a 152, was definitely a VFR aircraft.
Yeah, I don't know.
I've never seen one.
I have never seen one. So here you have, a pilot who has an instrument rating, no instrument flight plan, flying at night into low clouds, and then taking a bunch of pictures. So there were amazing things, the selfies. There was all kinds of evidence of this. Todd, the GoPro in the cockpit thing is an interesting phenomenon, and I'm afraid. I think it does, not only is it a distraction, I think it prompts pilots maybe to do things they might not do, do you think? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I'm going by my experience working with the internet for several decades now. And certainly, given that the GoPro is portable, highly capable, and it's used often for sharing what you're doing. And of course, social media and the internet is perfect for that. And if you're going to have a GoPro on the internet, on YouTube or what have you, and you want to have some clicks, you will want to do something that's not just a normal, everyday, plain vanilla flight. So yes, there might have been some incentive to do something a little bit unusual. The fact that they were at night in IMC conditions was unusual enough.
Right. It could be an exciting photographic moment running and with the clouds just above you and the ground coming up at you. You know, daredevil stuff. The old barnstorming.
I will say this, though, maybe. A GoPro in nighttime conditions isn't for crap. It's a terrible camera for low light. So I don't know what they were really thinking on this one, frankly. But, I don't know.
And people... also, this is an instrument flying sort of thing. In a Part 91 operation, I don't believe there are any limitations for taking off in IMC conditions. There are certainly limitations for landing, depending on the airport in IMC. So the question I'd like to ask, and I'll see if it's answered somewhere in the documentation, was the airport they're flying out of good enough to land in, given the instrument conditions they had at that time, the visibility conditions, rather?
Well, they had 5 miles and 500 feet? So that's a good question. I mean, you pretty much need an ILS to do that. I mean, there are some non-precision approaches.
700, 800 feet.
700. Yeah, that could be on the edge for a non-precision. But, and of course, with Part 91, you can shoot the approach, even if it's below minimums, and see if but you still cannot bust those minimums. And that's the key thing that I think confuses a lot of pilots, just because you can initiate the approach under Part 91, which you can't do under 135. That does not mean that you can bust the minimums as you get close to the runway. And I think a lot of accidents occur because of that temptation to go just a few more feet, right? Now, in this case, I think it was a spatial disorientation in IMC, stall spin scenario, of course. And that's a story we talk about all the time.
And of course, at night, limited visibility, and you're in an aircraft, we presume, had the proper instrumentation for instrument flight. But even turning your head at the wrong time, especially if you're turning the aircraft, could get your inner ear all, 6 ways from Sunday out of whack. And it doesn't take but a few seconds of not knowing exactly what you're doing because you're just disoriented before the aircraft is in a position where you can't get out of it. And again, this is nighttime, limited visibility. They perhaps did not see have a distinct horizon or a distinct view of the ground, it might have been more difficult than usual trying to right yourself in that situation.
Yeah, probably a very basic six pack on that 150, and that's about it for instrumentation. So you know, I don't know how to when I these two together just make me wonder sometimes whether people what are people missing along the way as far as learning lessons when it comes to aviation. Where is the disconnect? Is this a failure of instruction? Is it a failure of the system writ large, or is it just there's always going to be a human being who wants to push the limit and pay the price?
Now, there are several GoPro recordings that they recovered. And on one of the recordings, it said, here's a line from the report. During the climb out portion of the flight, the pilot uses a cell phone to take a selfie. The camera's flash was activated and illuminated the cockpit area. Now, I don't know about you, but if there's low light conditions and you illuminate a flash in your face and you're flying an airplane, that's a combination I don't really want to do.
Bindum, and this isn't an inexperienced pilot. I mean, he has a commercial rating and he's an instructor, ground school instructor.
This 726 hours.
Yeah. And so to think he was, you know, he was teaching others how to fly. Maybe that's the problem. Those guys like this shouldn't be the CFII, right? I don't know.
Well, it's the old question of what is, you know, within regulations and what makes sense. And to get where this pilot got, obviously went through the process of getting the commercial rating and the instrument rating and the instructor rating. But does that mean that this is a person that you want to fly with? Does this mean this is a person who has, at age 29, not a young person, I mean, not an old person either, but again, they've been an adult for over a decade. Do they have the presence of mind? Did this person have the presence of mind to make the kinds of reasonable decisions that would keep that pilot and anyone on the airplane safe? In this case, in my opinion, the answer is no.
Yeah. And you know what? It wasn't a good night to take pictures, whatever you may say. It was dark.
There's a lot of things, you know, negative things facing him, and he still chose to do it.
Yeah.
Which, as you guys were talking, I was reminded of a recent news program that I was on talking about helicopters and mainly Kobe Bryant mm-hmm. and that person from Africa that was very wealthy. And
right.
both of those helicopters were essentially scud running. So even though we have all kinds of rules and all kinds of examples of accidents that happen when you behave like that, they're still out there.
Yeah. I think we've learned a lesson here, which we keep learning over and over again. And I hope we take it to heart. I hope you take it to heart. What, you know, why don't, Todd, what are your final thoughts on these two incidents separated by more than a decade, but joined together by pilot stupidity and hubris, I guess?
Well, again, having been in the cockpit myself, not that many hours, not as much as either of these two people. Are there some times where I thought about doing things or maybe on the edge of the regulation? Sure. Anything this far off the edge? No. But we have to realize that we're dealing with human beings here. And they live in the context of, hey, you know, I'm doing this really special thing, flying an airplane. I've worked hard to get here. I spent a lot of money to get here. Let me have a little fun now and then. I'm not against that. But this is the kind of fun where if you sit back for a minute and think about it, it's like, look, I'd love to join the Mile High Club. For whatever reason, if you want to do that, what's the safest way to do it? A, have someone else fly. B, you know, make sure the person who's flying is paying attention only to flying and nothing else. In this case, they were trying to, I don't know, save time, save money, save whatever, and do it all at once. Obviously, it didn't end well. The second, I think, is a bit more, pernicious in the sense of the internet era that we're in, the social media era that we're in. There are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in the aviation world who put things online, myself included. Some of them put things online when they're flying. Not me so far. But the temptation, anytime you're trying to get traffic and clicks and eyeballs, is to do something a little bit different. I'm all for that. I've done it on more than one occasion. I've been around long enough where I'm not going to be inclined to do that in the sky, if for no other reason that if I'm successful in putting out there, I'm putting out a bad example. And part of what we're doing here is, in addition to having a little fun with these stories, is to set an example. It's like, we're not against having fun. We're not against doing something creative in the air. We're not against GoPro cameras. But we are against doing things that, you know, go beyond common sense. And as I've said before in another show, the person who is making that decision may not see clearly what they're doing, but the people around them, and no one flies alone. You have other people who are in aviation. You have your immediate family. You have your friends. You have your buddies you're taking up with you in the plane. If you see something happening in the person who's a pilot, doesn't matter how many hours they have, speak up. Even if you're speaking up as only to say, you know what? Sounds like a good idea, but I don't want to go ahead and do this. That might be enough for them not to fly that day. That might be enough to keep them alive.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm always talking about the pre-flight, pre-planning. And did these, there's the first couple, the Mile High Club assumed, did they do a pre-plan? It sure sounds like it. Sure sounds like they pre-planned to do this very event. For whatever reason. And you know what? This is activity on both cases you should not conduct, you know, as a pilot. You're held to a higher level of moral code, you know. A commercial pilot in the second case, right? If the FAA got that GoPro with no accident there, he would have had a problem with his commercial ticket. Because they have the ability to remove that from you. So just do what's expected of you, all of you. Pre-plan your flight, good pre-flight, put your head on a swivel when you're flying, and don't do anything stupid.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.